Okay.
Excuse me. So it's an interesting time that you have small quantum systems that are beyond our ability to simulate, that you can work with in the lab. And there's, of course, the goal of could we take these and make quantum processors out of them? And if we could we use them for quantum computing? Or more likely, could we use them for quantum simulation? And of course, there's a few interesting examples of that being reported in the literature today. You can also, of course, use small quantum systems as sensors. Of course, you can also use them for communication. And we're starting to understand the details of that. The challenge with sensors and communication, of course, is that you want to have devices that perform based upon entanglement, so you can get a big increase. So there's, well, of course, lots and lots of quantum sensors based on coherence, you know, a laser, magnetic resonance imaging. And they have an advantage, but it's not the huge advantage that you would like. Their advantage is stability. It's not sensitivity and precision. And that's the piece that entanglement allows us to do. So we want to see where that comes from and how we can use it in our systems. The idea of a processor and using that for simulation, that is, I think, one of the most exciting pieces. And we'll just unfortunately touch on it. But you know that there's a lot of physical systems where, you know, take the quantum Hall effect, where we guess the Hamiltonian. Actually, we guess the states. We don't have a Hamiltonian. You know, we have some effective Hamiltonian, but we don't have anything that ties to the physical system. And these multi-body dynamics are just impossibly complicated to work through. And so to have a small system even, which is what we're trying to build today, that allows us to map our problem onto it and to study the dynamics without ever having to know anything about all the internal structures, right? We'll never learn everything in the state of this multi-body system. But, you know, if we're clever, and if theorists can tell us how to be clever, then we can learn enough about those systems. And that's the goal. Now, today, I hope you know that there are small quantum processors. The biggest are around 15 spins, or atoms. And the hope or the plan is that in 5 to 10 years, we'll have a 100-qubit quantum processor that we can do anything with. And that's the stated goal of many groups. So the IBM group, the Santa Barbara, Yale, Delft, the group at MIT, the group at JQI, and our group as well. And so it seems reasonable. And we think we know the controls and how to do it, and we've built small systems. And 100 qubits might sound small if you compared it to 100 bits. But remember that to simulate quantum physics on a classical computer is hard, and that your laptops, you can, if you try really hard, you can simulate about 20 spins. If you take Milky Way 2, the biggest computer that China has. China today has the two biggest computers that are publicly talked about. You can simulate about 32, 34 spins. You know, if you took all the classical resources in the known universe and you made a classical computer out of it, it could hold a state corresponding to 300 qubits. So So 100 qubits is well on the way. It's beyond the classical computing capacity of anything we'll ever have as a classical computer. Now, what I want to do, given that we have this short time, is I want to focus on control. The challenge with building a quantum computer is control. You've probably all heard of David DiVincenzo's 5 criteria. I assume that Ray went over that. Did everyone take Ray's course? Yeah? Okay. And you can rewrite David's criteria all in terms of control. It says, hey, I must be able to prepare a ground state or a fiducial state. I must be able to have a complete set of gates, so I can take any state to any other state. I must be able to do it with a pretty low error term. I need to be able to make a measurement on the system. And each one of those, of course, is just a statement of control. So we're going to look at control. And the piece that I didn't say for David's 5, there was only 4 there, is you would like to have a tensor product structure of qubits. And of course, David's criteria were written a long time ago, late last century. And if he was going to write them today, he'd change them a little bit. What we'll find is that we don't really need projective measurements, but we do need to be able to get something out probabilistically. And our idea of what good control is, there's lots of freedom, and we don't need to compute with qubits, but we do need to have a tensor product structure. So I'm going to tell you, so we're going to start with qubits. And the idea is you should interrupt me. The more you interrupt me, the better. Okay. And we're also going to change the way that we run the class this year. So what we're going to do is we're going to have, instead of 5 lectures a week, we're going to have 4 lectures a week. And on Wednesday, we'll meet in the Sky Room, and we'll talk. So we'll turn the microphone off, and we'll just make that a bridge between the lectures, the tutorials, and the first tutorial of the week and the second tutorial of the week. Good. Okay. So let's talk about control of spin. And there are lots and lots of systems where we have spin 1/2. And of course, Ray taught you about 1 of nuclear magnetic resonance, which is an ensemble of spin 1/2 pieces in a system that's very easy to control a small processor on and is never going to lead to a quantum computer. So it's an interesting test bed of things. The first demonstration was in atomic beams, where we really had individual ions that we would send through a flight tube, and we would control the state during that flight. And in many ways, this is the place to get insight. Of course, we're also not going to make a quantum computer out of flight tubes. But it is a nice way to look at the control systems we have. And the experiments that we have for spin 1/2 are defined by the people that were doing these experiments back in the 40s. And so we'll go back to that. Today, we have scattering of an electron off a defect. is very much like the flight tubes. So I have some electrical device, some semiconductor, a couple of leads, and somewhere here I have a defect. Yeah, if it's silicon, phosphorus is a good defect. And I can send one electron at a time through this channel. But then I can set the Fermi edge of this electron so that it can only be transmitted conditionally on the state of this phosphorus. And so I can use this electron to tell me, just like in a Stern-Gerlach experiment, what is the state of the phosphorus? And of course, I can then control the state of the phosphorus and do all of the experiments, one electron at a time, just as I would do one ion at a time here. We'll talk about diamonds. So there's a nitrogen vacancy defect in diamond. So as you take a single crystal diamond, you tear out two atoms, you stick in one nitrogen, and next to the nitrogen is a vacancy. And what happens is that that defect will have an electronic structure that is optically active. And so it'll give us a way of connecting photons to the spin state. We'll be able to control and read out the state of one individual defect. It involves a few spins, but the defect is atomic. And we'll be able to see that too. Okay, so we have all of these systems. But of course, spin 1/2 really is just an abstraction that says, hey, I want to play with two energy levels. Okay? So the spin 1/2 is broader than these spin things. We use it as a model for any two-level system. And so I can have some potential. There'll be a set of energy levels in it. And if I would like my dynamics to be limited to those two levels, then I can talk about it in terms of a spin 1/2 particle. You know, it's not a real spin 1/2 particle. And as soon as I leak information into a higher level, of course, I'll see that. But we can find lots of examples of these. We can find them in ions. We can find them in mechanical systems. We can make them in superconducting systems. And there'll be lots and lots of levels, but we only care. Well, I shouldn't say it that way. We're going to control the system. We're going to do the work to control the system so that our information only ever spans two levels, and then we'll think about it that way. Okay. Now, if we think about control of a spin 1/2 system, it is duck soup, right? You've all played with bar magnets. There's nothing else that happens in spins than what happens in your bar magnets. And so the first piece that we get is we say that there's two levels, spin up and down. And of course, we label these up and down by the projection of the magnetization along some direction. And by convention, that direction is z. And so then what we're really saying is that the magnetic quantum number along z is plus or minus 1/2. We typically just draw the arrows. And the Hamiltonian that we want is the Zeeman Hamiltonian and, of course, Pauli operator, the field and the gyromagnetic ratio. So the gyromagnetic ratio is a constant for any nucleus. And if I look at proton, its value is 4,000 hertz per Gauss. So you know the Earth's magnetic field is half a Gauss. So if you go out to the pond behind PI, you can measure that there's noise coming from that pond. It's a little bit below 2,000 hertz because here the Earth's magnetic field is a little bit over 0.3 Gauss, right? The Earth's field varies locally. But, you know, any pool of water has a source of noise, and the source of noise comes just because all the spins in the water are precessing, and they're precessing at the Earth, or about the Earth's magnetic field. It's one of the ways we find water. Okay. And H-bar will never appear again in any of my lecture. Good. It's useful to remind you that one Gauss is a very small number in terms of Tesla. And so if we're making a lab magnet, normally we'll talk in Tesla. Okay. And of course, the Zeeman interaction is typically given as minus the magnetic moment dotted into the field. The reason it shows up like this is that's the magnetic moment. And we've restricted the field to be along the z direction. So we've said in this particular experiment that we have a strong field, which we call B0, along the z axis. Okay? Good. Now, of course, if I look at the energy levels as a function of field, it turns out that the gyromagnetic ratio can have either sign. And so feel free to label them any way you want. And then you can say, well, it's silicon instead of proton in terms of the labels. But the difference here is given by the Zeeman interaction. So this is energy. And if we take a field that's typical of a laboratory magnet for a proton, that's 100 megahertz. So 2 Tesla is the biggest field you can make with an electromagnet. And it's a reasonable small field to make with a superconducting magnet. Today, we can make fields as high as 22 Tesla with superconducting magnets. And of course, with pulse magnets, we can go much, much higher. But we have this nice range. And you can see that things are in the radio frequency. So if you set your field to 2.35 Tesla, then what happens is your local FM radio station is going to run your experiment for you. And that too is easy to see. Now, this energy difference is small. And, you know, small compared to KT, right? And so if I took the number in the upstate divided by the number in the downstate, I should describe that in terms of Boltzmann's equations, but the energy is so small that I can describe this in terms of just the first linear term. And this piece is about 10 to the minus 5 in that particular case. And so if I was going to describe the density matrix of the spin system, then I would describe the density matrix as there's a probability that the spin is in the up state, and there's a probability that the spin is in the down state, and those probabilities are both roughly 1/2, except about 1 in a million spins is more up than down. Okay? And so we would describe the density matrix as being the identity plus the small piece, epsilon sigma z. Of course, the identity piece is never going to be affected by any of our experiments. I should be careful about that. Of course, in a relaxation experiment, they'll show up. But if I'm doing something unitary, it won't change, right? And so typically, we talk about the reduced density matrix, which is proportional to just sigma z, and throw away the identity piece. Okay. This is the regime that you would be in also if you were doing magnetic resonance imaging. So if you are ever in a hospital and they want to look inside you with magnetic resonance, then they'll stick you into a field of about 2. It's usually today 1.5 in Canada, 3 Tesla in the States. Okay. Now, NMR is easy and it has 2 rules. So the first rule you found right there, which is just to say that the system is polarized in the Zeeman interaction. The second piece is dynamics. And you know, the only thing that happens for a spin 1/2 particle, it's a magnetic dipole. The only way to rotate a magnetic dipole is to have another magnet. Okay? And so the only interaction is a torque. Of the magnetic moment. Crossed into the field. And we've already have a field along the z-axis. So we know what that's going to do. We'll go through and calculate it. But it's the torque, so the field along the z-axis says that anything in the xy plane is going to be rotated. Okay, it's going to process about the field. And of course, since we start off with our system in eigenstates of z, it'll be bloody uninteresting, right? Because it'll commute with that interaction. And so what we will need to do is to find a way of creating a state that's not at equilibrium. Let's just go through it. So we say that we have a Hamiltonian, the Zeeman Hamiltonian. And it's useful to just describe a frequency, right? The gyromagnetic ratio is 2 pi hertz per Gauss, the field's in Gauss. And so this quantity is a frequency, so we'll just describe that directly. And the factor of 2 simply becomes out because we're dealing with polymatrices instead of spin matrices. And so the unitary, that is the exponentiation of this. Has a simple structure. Now, here it's worth talking about. So if you go through the literature, you'll find that if you're a physicist, then you would describe this like so, that omega times time is an angle, and you would keep that as an angle. If you're a quantum information person, you would take that factor of two and stick it into the angle. And it gives you this odd piece of talking about pi over four gates, or T gates, in quantum information, which if you looked at the Bloch sphere will rotate you by pi over two. Okay, and it comes from this difference. Okay, but we're going to keep our angles and the factor of two, so we'll lose that stuff. Yeah? Okay, so now I'm assuming that all of you have gone through and expanded this in a Taylor series, recognize that if you're talking about spin one half systems, that the Pauli is square to the identity. Only in the spin one half case, you'll never make that mistake otherwise, right? And that we can re-describe this as perfect. Okay. So now we have the evolution of the system that rho at some time t is equal to u rho zero t u inverse. And if I take my density matrix as being sigma z, then of course, as I sandwich it between these operators, then I'll see that nothing happens, nothing happens. And so sigma z, Zeeman goes to sigma z, but sigma x, under the Zeeman interaction, is going to go to sigma y, and sigma y under Zeeman is going to go to sigma x. And of course, we can rewrite this out as saying that sigma x will go to cosine So yes, it looks like a torque. And of course, it shows up as cosine of theta because I sandwiched it between two of these. Okay, and we end up reducing sine theta over two times cosine theta over two into a double angle. Nothing interesting. Okay, so that's almost all the dynamics. The only thing that happens is if you apply a field of spins, process about it. Okay, and if you put the spins in a field, they tend to align with the field. Okay, Now, during World War II, so before World War II, the beamline experiments were done. And they were done by Rabi and by Ramsey. I'm going to get to them in just a second. During World War II, two things happened. One, Bloch and Purcell were both young researchers at the MIT radiation lab. At the World War II, everyone didn't only come together to make the bomb, they also came together to make radar. And basically, it was done in three places. It was done in England, it was done at the Naval Research Lab, and it was done at MIT. And Purcell and Bloch were at MIT, and they learned there how to build RF electronics, a useful thing for a physicist at that time. The other thing that happened is in Holland, Holland was occupied, but it wasn't conscripted. So that everything was closed. The universities were closed in Holland. But the people were just hanging around. And so Goethe, a great scientist who spent some of his time in Amsterdam and then went back to Leiden during the war, collected his students. And he said, let's get together and do the most interesting experiments we can. And so he got his students together. Now, this is in the middle of a war and they're occupied. So, having power is a hard thing. Building an electromagnet is a nearly impossible thing. And building RF electronics is illegal, right? All the radios were collected. But still, they did it. And Goethe has a series of beautiful papers. They unfortunately all have the same title: Failure to Observe, and then fill in something that someone else got the Nobel Prize for. And so he did this for NMR, he did this for ESR, he did this for the Mossbauer effect. And in his papers, he describes exactly how you should go about doing these experiments. And then he describes how he did it in his lab and why he thinks he failed. In the NMR case, it's particularly tragic because, in fact, his equipment was good enough to see NMR. But remember that this is really early in the ideas of quantum physics, experimental quantum physics. And some things weren't known. The density matrix, for instance, hadn't been invented yet. Qubit was still to come. More so, ideas of relaxation weren't known. And so the only thing people knew about relaxation was that if you're going to have spontaneous emission, so I was going to take the energy of a change in state, and I was going to put it into the vacuum. We know the rate of that. And of course, you've all calculated that in your E&M course and in your quantum mechanics course. Yes and yes. Maybe. And you'll remember or not that it goes as frequency to the fourth. And so if you just plug in the numbers for a magnetic dipole, then the rate, it looks like the rate of thermalization for spins is age of the universe. So when Goethe set everything up and he looked and he didn't see anything, he assumed that the reason he didn't see something was that the time for the spins to have an imbalance in their energy levels was too long. Now, he was right about that. But he was right about it because he chose a sample that was a rigid material. And so there were no modes, no phonon modes in the material to accept the energy. And if he had just poured water into his coil instead of using the solid polymer he did use, he would probably would have seen the signal. So Goethe will come back. But he described how to do everything. Now, after the war, Bloch and Purcell, who are both great people, decide to go off and do the experiment themselves. Purcell goes to Harvard. You may know Purcell because he wrote a book on E&M that's still used. Great classical physicist. And Bloch, you certainly know, because this is the same Bloch of Bloch wave functions. Okay, so Bloch, of course, has developed many of the ideas we use in quantum mechanics. And they publish, they go back, they have lots of resources, they do the experiments, they see the experiments, there's lots of interesting stories, but I won't tell you them all. But Bloch, the quantum mechanics guy, publishes a classical picture of quantum mechanics. And Purcell publishes the quantum one. And the reason is that Bloch could prove, and did prove, that there was an isomorphism between the classical motion of a dipole and the expectation value of, and the motion of the expectation values of an ensemble of spins. Okay? And so when we talk about spin one-half dynamics, we often start by looking at Bloch's equations that tell us the overall dynamics of a system. And they're going to tell us how the expectation values change under different interactions for a spin one-half system. And it's important to remember that the Bloch equations, although they're a classical description of the motion of the expectation values, they're fully drivable quantum mechanically. We went through the first steps right there. And nothing is left out. You can use them as long as you limit yourself to one spin one-half particle. And this is, of course, the origin, if you know it, of the isomorphism between O3 and SU2. If you don't, we won't use it. Okay, so let's talk about Bloch's equations. So they're normally written in terms of the magnetization vector . But it's useful to remember that the magnetization vector is the expectation value. So this piece is just what I've already written on the board over there. Okay? It simply says that if I have an X component of the magnetization, it rotates into plus Y, and a Y component rotates into minus X. These signs are actually opposite of what Zeeman would tell you, and that's another convention because we're always looking at a difference of a frequency. And so since the Bloch equations are connected to an observable, they pick up an extra change in sign. And of course, the Z component doesn't change. We'll just put a zero there. And this piece of the dynamic, regardless of what spin one-half system we were talking about, is talked about as precession. And unfortunately, we think about the dynamics of a spin one-half particle in terms of a top. The motion of a top used to be something that classical physicists had spent a lot of their time studying. Hopefully, you guys didn't do that. And so we still use the term, but we won't make the connection. Now, this piece just talks about the unitary dynamics. And of course, we still need to get back to the equilibrium state, which says that we're in a ground state of the Zeeman Hamiltonian. And so there's two terms that come out of this. I'm going to leave a hole here. So this piece tells us that if we have magnetization that is a coherence that's in the transverse plane, the XY plane, that that will decay. And it'll decay away with the time constant given by T2. And at the moment, that's just a label. And then the Z component will return to its equilibrium value. With a different time constant T1. Now, the reason that there's two different time constants is in order to go back to the thermal equilibrium, in order to get the populations right, I need to exchange energy with the lattice. So the T1 process is an energy exchange that is a photon of energy or a phonon jumping between the systems, okay? And your lattice, of course, says that, let's take the water case. It says you have one water molecule you're interested in, and there's Avogadro's number of water molecules surrounding it. And so you can move energy between those. And we'll talk about how that happens. T2, there's no energy exchange needed, because if I'm causing the coherence to vanish, then I'm not changing the population levels. Okay, so if I have a coherence, 1 over the square root 2 spin up plus spin down, and then that decays, it'll decay to the identity state, to the spin being equally likely to be up or down, okay? And this decay, this T2 decay, says what's the lifetime of the coherence? Talk more about that in a second, too. Okay. So I'll make sure that I get to where we need to be for. For your tutorial. So now, here, this piece here, we're going to add as a field that allows us to rotate the spins. Okay, so this is going to be our unitary control. And allow me to put it off till tomorrow's lecture so that I can tell you about these pieces first. And it's really this interplay that I want to talk about. So, if we have a spin, and so we have Bloch sphere, and so the spin up case is here, the spin down case is sitting here, and along sigma x, we have a coherence. And we know that what happens with this, that if we leave it in a magnetic field, then it'll rotate by a frequency omega naught. And it'll rotate around, and as it's rotating, it'll decrease in amplitude slowly. And if this frequency is 100 megahertz, these times tend to be seconds. This time tends to be of order minute. Okay? So T2 says you're going to have the system rotating around, and it's going to rotate around millions of times before it vanishes. It spirals back into the origin here. Now, there's two ways that this can relax. I can have it relax just like it did, or I could say that there's parts of my ensemble that have see a slightly different field. And this is one of the most common annoyances of looking at spin systems, that we end up having a range of fields. Now let's go back to Bloch's equations. What Bloch's equations tells us is that we're looking at the dynamics of an expectation value. In order to measure an expectation value, what do? You take a spin system, you take a spin, you prepare it, you do your experiment, you make a measurement, you record it, then you take the same one or another one, you prepare it in exactly the same way, you do exactly the same experiment, you record it, and you measure the statistics, having done that many, 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 many times. And if we're up in the beamline experiments, then that's really what we do. We send one ion through our beamline, we record it on a filament, and then we send the next one, then we send the next one, then we send the next one. If we're doing it in NMR, what we do is we take a pool of whatever it is we're looking at, say water, and we fill the coil with it so that we measure the expectation value directly in one shot. But it's still the same idea that we're taking many, many copies, preparing them in exactly the same state, we hope, and doing exactly the same experiment, we hope, and getting out the statistics. Okay. So now then, we can contrast two cases. The first case says I have a value of T2, and in this particular experiment, let's just measure along sigma x. So if I measured along sigma x, then what would I see? I would see an oscillation. Given by the Zeeman frequency, and I would see a decay. Given by the T2, and all we've done is integrated Bloch's equations. Case one: I have a short T2. Case two: I have a long T2 but many fields. If I have an exponential decay, you probably won't remember, but at one point you knew that the Fourier transform of that was a Lorentzian line shape. And of course, if I have a short T2, the line width is reciprocal. So if I take the Fourier transform of this, I see a Lorentzian. So now this is in frequency space. And the width at half maximum is pi over T2. Okay. One over pi times T2. Sorry about that. So if I have a short T2, I have a broad line. If I have a long T2, I have a sharp line. But if I have many fields, then I have an overlap of many sharp lines. And we can arrange that this overall line shape looks exactly like that. But the underlying physics is quite different. In this case, we're losing our information here. The information is still there, okay? It's just not available in this particular experiment. So what I want you to do is to think about those two differences. I want you to draw the block vectors for those, okay? Before you start to solve any problem, think about trying to obtain some insight into that problem. And the way in this case is just to sit down and draw what happens to the Bloch vectors in those two cases. And of course, what I'm hoping you'll do is draw Bloch vectors for each of the different fields, right? Okay? And then ask yourself how you can learn the difference between those two. And notice as you're doing this that in case two, there's a correlation between the field and the dynamics of the spin. And that's built into the structure. Okay? Good. We'll stop here. Any questions? Yes. In this case, nothing. They're the same field. Now, later on, like tomorrow, we'll put in another field. So as you're thinking about this experiment, notice I don't start with the eigenstate of the Zeeman Hamiltonian. I start off in this coherence. And so I've left this open question of how do I get from the equilibrium state to this state. And of course, you know the answer, right? How do I go from here to here? Okay. There's only two rules in NMR, right? You polarize and you have a torque. So if I want to go from Z to X, I'm not going to do that by polarizing. I could apply a field along the x direction and wait and polarize. It's not the answer I'm hoping you'll give me. How do I go from z to x in a rotation? All right. So Robbie got the Nobel Prize for that answer. It's already been given. We don't give another one. Okay, so we'll pick it up tomorrow.